Next speaker is Ari Bigwater, and he'll be speaking on giving and receiving Charles A. Coulson's witness as a Christian Scientist.
Thank you, Don. I don't have a paper to give you, but I could make a plug for a book that's on the table, the book table. It's a book edited by Nicholas Rupke. It has the title Eminent Lives in 20th Century Science and Religion. There's a chapter on E.O. Wilson. There's a chapter on Roland Fisher. There's a chapter on Coulson that I wrote. Ted Davis wrote a chapter on an Orthodox Christian engineer pupil. So what I have is in a bit an abstract of that talk with some additional comments. It is August 9, 1951, 5:45 p.m., almost exactly 56 years ago. We are in Pollock Hall in the University of Edinburgh, and site of the 113th meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. The speaker is Charles Alfred Coulson, recently chosen to be a fellow of the Royal Society, and the person selected to give a lecture entitled The Place of Science in the Christian Faith. He is present at the invitation of Dr. Oliver Barclay, who represents the selection committee of the Research Scientist Christian Fellowship, the precursor of Christians in Science. Barclay writes on the 6th of March, 1951, "We feel this first meeting of the RSCF at the BA should be a success." Besides the invitation to Coulson, Barclay also offered some ideas for a suitable topic. Quote, "I do not know what you have in mind for a subject. I would suggest something along the lines of fairly fundamental apologetics would be best. For example, something on the difficulties for Christian faith raised by a scientific attitude, or perhaps something on materialism and Christian faith." Coulson did not follow the advice and later commented in a letter to Professor Nash 4 months after the event that the lecture was almost acceptable to the people who invited me. I will come back to this question of acceptance. But the obvious question, why invite Charles A. Coulson to give a speech profiling your organization at a national meeting of the prestigious BA? Who was it? Charles Alfred Coulson was born on December 13, 1910, in the English country town of Dudley, Worcestershire. When his father became Inspector of Technical Colleges for Southwest England in 1920, the family settled in Bristol. Coulson attended Clifton College, where he began in classics, but through the leading of an influential mathematics teacher, Fuzzy B, as the schoolboys called him, was led to study mathematics. His mother, Annie, former headmistress of Tipton School, had already taught him long multiplication at the age of 3. Coulson came to read mathematics at Trinity College, Cambridge University in 1928, whose Neville's Court and Wren Library is pictured in this winter scene. Coulson quickly became involved in his studies and student activities, such as the chess and cricket clubs. His participation in small religious group meetings and the weekend services they held in many of the local Methodist chapels caused his father to express concern that he was neglecting his academic work. That anxiety proved to be misplaced. In the mathematical tripods of the maze, Coulson obtained a first class with a score of 553. His closest competitor had a 426. The impact these small, intimate group meetings made on Coulson was indeed life-changing. After a group retreat held in June 1930, he wrote, quote, "I began to see that Christianity for me must be something broader than my own self. I began to see that religion was something that got beyond me and God. It included everybody. I came up this term a mystic. I went down a missionary." End quote. I would like to use four quotations to highlight important moments or aspects of Coulson's life. Here is the first one, written soon after his conversion at the age of 19. My epitaph. "Here lies a youth who loved, who lived, and who learned to give God thanks for that love and for that life." A year later, Coulson preached a sermon entitled My Testimony, in which he gave more details about his conversion from a nominal to a more committed Christian. Quote, "That term was the most wonderful term in my life. There were 10 of us, and together we sought for God, and together we found him. I learned for the first time in my life that God was my friend. God became real to me, utterly real. I knew him, and I could talk with him, as I had never imagined it possible before. Life has a purpose, and that purpose colored everything. Coulson's sermons and letters from the early 1930s give us some insight into what consequences he attributed to this dramatic change for his life's work. Several themes reoccur in these reflections. The Wesleyan Methodist concern with holiness or perfection, the need for fellowship, and the necessity of social action. Coulson's letters to his friends are sprinkled with references to the unemployed, to the general housing situation in Britain, and to German Jewish refugee scientists passing through the Cavendish Lab at Cambridge. Coulson and his group even hosted some of the Gerald marchers on their way to Parliament. For Coulson, becoming a devoted Christian also implied becoming a pacifist. He soon joined the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Methodist Peace Fellowship and served on a number of their committees throughout his life. During the Second World War, while living in Dundee, Scotland, he was granted the status of a conscientious objector. Coulson respectfully declined to work on a research project when his advisor, Leonard Jones, could not assure him that the work was not related to the war effort. Coulson wished to lead a life based on his understanding of Christian principles. When Coulson assessed the formative influences on his thought, he mentioned three people: Alex Wood, Quaker physicist at Emmanuel College, Charles Raven, canon at Christ's, and the famous Quaker physicist Arthur Eddington of Trinity College. Wood in particular opened Coulson's eyes to the plight of the poor and provided a model of the kind of person Coulson wanted to be. Quote, "All that I ever knew of poor law administration and the means test, all power of judgment about unemployment and social justice, I owed to him." Alex Wood's authority in these matters sprang from a deep Christian love for all his fellows. There was something about the man. He was so attractive that I felt I wanted to be like him. If there is a single theme that characterized Charles Coulson's view of life, it is captured by the phrase giving and receiving. In a BBC radio broadcast, I Speak for Myself, aired in December 1950, he reflected on some of his life's experiences. Coulson said, "Giving and receiving, those are the key words. It is that which holds our lives together and makes sense of all those separate experiences. In science, for example, we who are heirs to all the splendor of achievements and modern discoveries have the responsibility to see that they are used for the betterment of humankind everywhere. To receive and not to give, that would be to deny the common humanity that we all share. This is why, for me, it is such a high privilege to carry scientific research a stage further." The theme of giving and receiving applied even more intensely to relationships with others and with nature. It was the theme Coulson wanted to live by, for it marked for him the path of holiness and the sacrificial giving of the one who said, quote, "If a man shall try to save his life, he shall lose it. But if he loses his life, for my sake, he shall find it." Coulson was committed to come down from himself to the world of others. Coulson's life displayed a unity of belief and action, and this unity was displayed in a variety of ways. Coulson's belief in a personal religious experience, the role of a group's fellowship in confirming that experience, and a call to holiness affected Coulson's approach to his scientific co-workers, his research group, and their activities, and his general promotion of science to a wider public. Coulson was determined to create a sense of fellowship in his research group and department. I might add, much different than that which occurred at those bibulous dinners at high table in his college Wadham. Departmental coffee times, picnics, and outings were instigated or organized for that end. Annual progress reports of his group's research were sent around the world to former colleagues and students. Undergraduate students were also made welcome in the Coulson household. This is a picture of the Department of Theoretical Chemistry at Oxford, at least in his time. Those of his research group who were ill or in the hospital would receive encouraging notes written in his own hand or otherwise typed on his small portable typewriter, some even composed in the cramped bus between Oxford and Heathrow Airport. As a consequence of living for others, there was a sense of urgency in Coulson's life. He was a driven person. Above all, he never wasted time, being comfortable with a work week of 70 hours. As his daughter, Wendy, once mentioned to me, she is the youngest in this family picture, on rare family weekend camping trips, Coulson would be so exhausted that on the first day he would often be found sleeping in the tent. In retrospect, Coulson was perhaps remembered more as an unusually gifted teacher than a great researcher. He had great sympathy for the intellectual difficulties of beginners and spared no pains in helping them. He loved lecturing and was a brilliant expositor, leaving his audience eager for more and confident that he could help them to an understanding which would enable them to select and solve problems. His summer schools in theoretical chemistry held at Oxford were world famous and a powerful influence in the dissemination of new ideas and the further development of theoretical chemistry. He insisted that one half of the participants be from what they called then the third world. Coulson sensed a real mission to the underdeveloped world. He thought that the overdeveloped West bore special responsibilities because it had the scientific know-how to eradicate the immense problems of storages of food, healthcare, and energy in the world. The West had to put its own house in order, he argued. His work as chairman of Oxfam and his work on the Central Committee of the World Council of Churches give ample evidence of these convictions. During 1959 to 1960, he was vice president of the British Methodist Conference, the highest position a layperson can achieve in Methodist circles. In the eyes of some, Coulson clearly paid a penalty for his versatility. He did not win a Nobel Prize in chemistry. If he had done fewer things, he would have done each more intensely. If he had chosen one branch of science, he would have gone further in it. But that was not Coulson's way. His strong social conscience led him to follow paths where he felt that he could be most useful. He was certainly a man who did not hide his light under a bushel. Let me now turn to Coulson's views on science and religion. Here's a second quotation. "Will you reflect for a moment on some of the things that I have been saying? I described a bond, the normal simple chemical bond, and I gave many details of its character. And I could have given many more. Sometimes it seems to me that a bond between two atoms has become so real, so tangible, so friendly, that I could almost see it. And then I awake with a little shock, for a chemical bond is not a real thing. It does not exist. No one has ever seen it. No one ever can. It is a figment of our imagination." This is a summary of Coulson's 1951 Tilden lecture, describing the elusive character of the chemical bond, which was the locus of much of his scientific work, and through which he gained his scientific credentials. In concluding his lecture, Coulson described wave mechanics, a way of describing chemical bonds, as giving, quote, "flesh and blood to the spirit which it has inherited," end of quote. Such language displays Coulson's incarnational reading of nature. Nature not read as organism, as magical, as mechanism, as an economy, or as an entangled bank, but rather as God's incarnational involvement with the earth. Coulson's style of attacking scientific problems in quantum chemistry, his view of the role of models and imagination in scientific work, and his emphasis on the wholeness or unity of personal experience also shaped his view of the science-religion connection. During the early 1950s, Coulson gave increasingly more expression to his concern that the Christian, and more specifically the Methodist community, was generally ill-equipped to speak to modern society, and frequently responded inappropriately out of fear and ignorance of scientific developments. In one sense, Coulson had arrived, having been elected a fellow of the Royal Society, and having become the Rouse Ball Professor of Mathematics at Oxford. While at King's College earlier on, he had also contributed to many BBC broadcasts. Within a four-year span, 1950 to 1954, he delivered a number of invited lectures on science and religion, published articles in ecclesiastical journals, and even wrote some book reviews for the British Journal of the Philosophy of Science. But now back to the Coulson lecture at the 1951 BA meeting I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, and to the question surrounding its qualified acceptance by Berkeley. Berkeley kindly thanked Coulson for the lecture. Quote, "it was most useful to us." But he expressed several reservations The lecture was too long. It contained, quote, two passages which might be understood as implying a form of pantheism. And three, it considered science to be a religious activity. This latter claim by Coulson led to an extensive exchange of letters, which may hold some value in examining in the time remaining, since they display some fundamental differences in interpretation of the terms religion and religious activity. The nuances are partially captured by the use of the preposition in found in Coulson's title, the place of science in Christian faith, and by Barclay's preference for using the preposition for the Christian faith, and the conjunction and the Christian faith. In short, Barclay argues that science should be a religious activity and can be for a Christian, but in no sense can science be religious for an atheist without thereby degrading the word religious. Religion and science are seen as basically complementary. For Coulson, science seen as a religious activity is significant in terms of the process of appeal to a larger body of professional scientists. Religion and science are not simply complementary, but inherently intertwined. Allow me to tease this out. Here is one particular formulation which raised questions in Barclay's mind, while I show you two others that Coulson also uses. Here's the one that came up in the lecture. If what I have said is even faintly true, then scientific inquiry holds within itself the stuff of a religious search. This is true in two senses. First, that the scientist himself keeps on coming up against feelings and convictions with an unmistakably spiritual content. And second, that his work is essentially religious. Coulson claimed that almost all of the branches of science recognize an inescapable intervention of the personal element. He appealed to what was to become and remained at the center of much of his thinking, his insistence on the wholeness of experience. Our experiences in science and religion are personal, and therefore both should reflect a deeper unity. Experience is at the heart of the pursuit of science. The primary task of the scientist is to understand nature rather than to control it. Let me give you a quote that reflects this. For the scientist, it is the experience which is primary. What I do, what I measure, what I see, what I think, these are the basic entities out of which science is built. It becomes my object to build a framework on which all these experiences can be hung, fitting into a pattern. It is in this sense that science is deeply Kantian. The one and only set of facts which are inconvertible for me are the experiences that I have myself. And by my experiences, I mean my experiments, my measurements, my feelings, my actions. But I am not content to let these separate experiences remain disconnected. I'm convinced that there is a pattern in which they fit. My science proceeds by the devising of new concepts to add to the framework already available for the better revealing of this pattern. I don't have time to tease this out, but there are similarities here to Polanyi's position, presented in his 1946 Riddle Memorial Lectures, and later developed in his book Personal Knowledge, a book reviewed by Coulson. As Polanyi argued, quote, our belief in science should be regarded as a token of much wider convictions. Coulson identified some of these convictions. Quote, that this world is not alien to us, but that its secret may be revealed to those who seek. That truth is accessible, and that mental integrity is both possible and necessary in its apprehension. That the criteria by which we judge the acceptance or rejection of some new scientific theory contains some elements which lie outside our particular culture and other elements which lie within it, that the patience, the austerity, the self-discipline without which science cannot prosper are not mere techniques but are somehow fundamental to the search. For Coulson, science and religion were expressions of a deeper unity that rested on a personal act of reflection. For him, science and religion did not represent contiguous domains, nor were they at war with each other. They were intimately related, but not in a simple complementary fashion. Their intimate relationship depended on personal experience, which could be partially communicated to others, but ultimately was exclusive. In our act of reflection on our experiences, which come to us and which are sought, we engage in an essentially religious activity. Okay. Now, this essentially religious activity, this reflecting on our experience, Coulson refers to as a theistic attitude. For Coulson, this theistic attitude purportedly dissolved the putative boundaries between science and religion. A person, he says, reflecting on his own being, which demands to be explained, on his environment, which gives him no peace until he seeks understanding of it, on reason and reflection, which cannot be described, on revelation, so persistently intruding, even into scientific effort, and on the sense of purpose and choice behind even a glance into the scientific sky, may well be tempted to assert that the coherence of the separate views of the mountain, one of his images, in the concept of reality and truth is one aspect of a wider coherence in an encounter with a purpose and a person to which he can give no lesser name than God. What then is meant by religion? Coulson suggested a definition. Religion is the total response of man to all his environment. The word total is crucial for Coulson's definition. By it, he meant to convey the whole person, thought, emotion, human relationships, etc. Similarly, the term environment included everything, speaking with St. Paul, things in heaven and in earth. Of course, very much depends on how we conceptualize the realities involved. Science, defined in terms of its content and methodology, the methodological naturalism, if you will fail to take seriously the rich context of scientific practice. It will then be easy to dismiss or minimize religious matters as irrelevant. Similarly, if religion is identified with theology or biblical doctrines, or limited to devotional practices, the role of faith will be greatly reduced in its ability to fund scientific practice. But what if we consider religion as not coming in from the outside as a friend corporate to scientific practice, but rather define religion as a response to God's revelation in the scriptures and creation that holds for every sphere of human endeavor? How would that shape or alter our view of the relation of science and religion? By acknowledging, or dare I say it, defining humans as being God-related or fixated on some imagined substitute, we may expect religion to play itself out at various points. If religion is the central pivot of human existence, which gives life as a whole its ultimate orientation, it should be reflected within scientific practice. I'm using the word religion now in the sense of commitment to a presumed source of ultimate meaning, an origin, the divine, the transcendent, if you will. The biblical scriptures, as I understand them, describe as idolatry the worship of the creature rather than the creator. That is, identifying some aspect, institution, thing, event, relationship as the first and last word about the world, a revelation, if you will. Therefore, religion, I would argue, is not some additional factor, one among many, constitutive of human action and personality, but rather religion lies at the very heart of what it is to be human. We are religious creatures through and through. All things have a sacred depth dimension, in the sense that all things derive their meaning as dependent creatures from the Creator. So the challenge, as I see it, is to determine as clearly as we can how this identifying mark of humans as God's imagers, namely built in relationship with Him, comes to expression both in the lives and work of others, as well as ourselves. Granted, it will not necessarily be easy to identify expressions of an individual's religion, particularly in some of the more exact sciences. But I'm convinced that religion deals with more than motivations for doing science, the moral ethical application of scientific discoveries, or the impingement of scientific discoveries and theories on particular theological formulations. What can we learn from this brief historical excursion into the life and work and witness of Charles Coulson? Let me just put it this way. One is to turn to a biological narrative, which Brooke and Cantor use. They want to move the focus away from the history of ideas and instead engage the life and experience of the individual, since it is through our life experiences that we directly engage both science and religion. I think this enriches our purview, but I think often it does not capture all the constitutive relationships between science and religion. In fact, it often does not take seriously enough the depth dimension of religion, its defining nature as to what it means to be human. We may engage science as active participants in its investigative regimen, or as casual observers and commentators of its grand theories, but religion is not something we engage. We may participate in religious practices, cultic events, worship services, but life lived is religion. We need to assume a stance which allows us to get beyond viewing persons as a Christian and a scientist. Only then will we do justice to a person as Charles Coulson and his efforts to consider religion not as irrelevant to, or in conflict with, or simply an influential factor on, but rather as the very ground for scientific practice. Thank you.
Just a few minutes for questions, comments.
I was very interested in what you said, drawing the analogy between Christmas thinking and philanthropy. That was what's interesting, they're both chemists.
Right.
All that sort of thing. The other point I want to make is that I think there's also a cousinly relationship to what you might call the Turnerist tradition, expressed in contemporary terms by somebody like Bernard Mulligan, for whom those people who are truly seeking truth without reserve are seeking God, whether they name him by name or not.
Yes. Yeah, thank you for those comments.
Any more comments, questions? Oh, you better keep talking, I guess.
Well, I can if they want to.
Because we've got a few minutes before the next.
Yes.
If science is, for him, like the experience is very important, doing science, what does that mean for how the general public understands science or is educated about science? You know, with technology going so rapidly and applying scientific principles, you know, I don't even know how the devices that I use work. Although I'm a scientist and can appreciate that, there's many of our lay people that, you know, our friends, Christian friends, that they can't make those steps to even comprehend the science that they're using.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, Coulson,
how can they experience it, I guess?
Coulson was a theoretical chemist, an applied mathematician with tremendous mathematical skills. He could take a complicated problem and simplify it, and knew the mathematical simplifications that were being made. But his other gift, and a sense of responsibility to the Christian community, but the larger community too, because he engaged atheists on BBC broadcasts, for example, in dialogue form. He wanted the general public to understand what science was about, how it works, in particular this sense of that we personally are engaged in this. Doing science is not just theoretical abstract ideas that a theoretical chemist might put on a page in the terms of a Hamiltonian equation describing some chemical situation. I mean, what's involved in being personally involved in the practice of science, not just a theoretical latest theory embellished mathematically, perhaps, but what's engaging and arriving at? How do we build this up? What choices do we make? What metaphors do we use? How do we describe it? And he was very adept at, gave a lot of sermons, gave a lot of talk to fifth formers, very engaged in the educational process. The way he ran his research group is entirely different from anyone else at Oxford, from what I can tell. And he insisted, for example, that the West had a tremendous amount of responsibility in the world. So that's why his theoretical chemistry schools, he insisted that almost half of the participants be from the third world. This is a sense out of obligation and responsibility.
One last question.
Yes.
Sitting here, I realized that he wrote his famous book on valence when he was 28. I've used the quotations, not from Science and Christian Greek, from Lady Book, which I think is a very profound insight for us today. It goes something like this. When we come to the scientifically unknown, it's not that we rejoice that we've found God, unless we seek to become a scientist.
I forget exactly where it is, but if you read this chapter that I have in the book, I have a reference to it.
I've got a reference of it.
He got it from Henry Drummond. about 1970. I made the first section, not at that point, but he appealed to him to join.
All right. Well, with that, let's thank our speaker again.